Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of June 4th, 2010. Declaring personal bankruptcy can feel a lot like failure, but when the debt is finally dumped, failure can turn to freedom.
You walk out of there feeling like you've got a set of wings and you want to fly. It's a pretty relieving feeling.
And even those of us who preach the gospel of personal money management commit financial sins.
It was very easy to get a credit card, and I did. And I used it. I used it for all these silly things.
We'll hear the confessions of a personal finance writer. But first, jobs are the story of this Great Recession. So hopes were high for a more positive employment report this week. And indeed, the economy added 431,000 jobs in May. But 95% of those were temporary census workers, so the picture is still bleak. And now we're going to put that picture alongside another one, the one being drawn along the Gulf Coast, as oil continues to spew from the BP disaster. Pete Garica is a shrimper, crabber, and fin fisherman in eastern New Orleans, and he joins us from his home, where we brought him in from working in the garden. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about what you do and how you got into this business.
Oh, well, I'm a third-generation commercial fisherman. My dad fished oysters and did a little shrimping, and his dad came from a little island in Yugoslavia, and he was a fisherman down there and became a fisherman and a boat builder down here. So I've been in it all my life. Labor love, I guess.
And how long have you been doing this?
Basically since around the early 70s, like 71 on my own, 72, something like that. You know, when I got out of high school, I jumped into this, and here I am, still in it.
Describe a typical day for you before the spill.
Well, I mean, we try to plan. Since the storm, I took a different outlook on life. I mean, we lost a lot in Katrina. We went through the storm where we were swimming, actually.
What do you mean you were swimming?
Our house fell down with a tornado before the hurricane came all the way through. So we wound up in a tree for about 7.5 hours for Katrina. So that puts a different spin on things. It was me, my mother, my daughter, my dog, and my wife. My wife disappeared from us for about 6 hours, and I found her after everything calmed down enough that I could get looking around and get everybody out the tree. But, you know, so you're learning through something like that. Material things don't mean that much to you. It's family, friends, and you just try to do what you can to make it from day to day, basically. So we work little farmers markets, selling fresh seafood to patrons here in New Orleans. We try to catch enough shrimp in the wintertime, you know, before the seasons close, large shrimp, to put some in the freezers, so we'll have some for this time of the year when it's usually smaller shrimp.
So presumably, like a lot of the fishing industry, you're up early in the morning, out there before dawn, and coming back in the afternoon?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, a lot of times I fish at night.
During
the shrimp season, basically, I trawl at night, you know, unless it's something where you shift it over to daytime, because sometimes it just don't work at night, so you got to shift to the day.
Yeah. Well, so what's a typical day like now? You are not out there, right?
Well, no, we kind of hit and miss. I go out there and catch a few fish. There is fresh fish available. There's some fresh crabs available. There's some fresh shrimp available. It's not in all areas, because what we have right now is, if you look at the maps of what they've been doing, it's sporadically, they close in areas precautiously.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if they feel that they might have some oil film or some oil or whatever in a given area within a 24-hour period, then they'll shut that section down. But, you know, we basically, you know, working, but just not as actively as we'd like to, because we lost our main run, which is the spring run. Some guys was making good money out there when it happened. And, you know, when we got shut down, you get shut down for like, what's 40-something days, 42 days, 43 days now. You lost that income that's only at that period of time, so you're not going to make it up. And hopefully we don't have the same thing happen. The beginning of August is when we usually get our first run on white shrimp. Hopefully the area where they're going to drop the eggs is not the area where the oil is at.
Well, there's a lot of hopefullys coming from you at this point.
Well, you know what it is we got this big white elephant in the room, and we don't know where he's going. And, you know, with this oil, it's a mystery, because you got oil you can see. And you also have oil that you can't see that's, you know, running in the lower tides. So that's why we got so many what-ifs and hopefullys and in the mix here.
Pete, what happens to you and your family if things end up being shut down for a long period of time, months, possibly years?
Well, I mean, if you can't do what we're doing, I mean, we, like I said, with storms and stuff in the past, we learn to be resilient. I mean, a lot of the things I do depend on people fishing, because I can go back to building boats, or I can build fiberglass, whatever's for people. You know, I've done build fiberglass swimming pools when things are slow. Got to do what you got to do to make ends meet. I mean, you like to fish. It's a labor of love. It's in your blood. I couldn't wait to get back on a bayou after Katrina, because it was killing me to be in Baton Rouge. I wanted to wake up in the morning and see birds and water and stuff that I'm used to, you know, instead of cars and people going to school. You know, but it, you know, if the fisheries is knocked down into a state that we can't survive, you know, make a living, turn over profit, we'll have to go to other things, you know. And
but it sounds like you have thought about what happens if fishing becomes something that you can't do.
Yeah, I mean, you gotta. I mean, this business is like gambling. I mean, it's a hit and miss proposition. When luck's with you, you make money. When it's not with you, you don't make money. I mean, you got hurricanes and all kind of natural things that affect us, you know, and move us around. You know, and that's another thing. We can move to another part of the state and fish. I mean, most of us do that anyhow, because you fish where the fishing's best. And luckily, we got a big coastline, you know, from Texas all the way to Mississippi. And if not, then you'll just do what you got to do, whether it be carpenter work or whatever you can do. And most of the fishermen are like that. They're handy with things, and they're resilient. You know, they're going to do what it takes to hang in there, so that when things get better, they can work again.
Pete Garica is a New Orleans shrimper. He's been doing that for going on 4 decades now. Pete, I don't think this story is going away anytime soon. Is all right if we check in with you again in a month or so?
Sure. I mean, you know, this is a work in process, I like to call it. We just take it day by day. We put no game plan together, and hopefully we can win the game. If not, then we'll see what the next move's going to be. You know.
All right. Best of luck to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we have more interviews of Gulf area fishermen. You can hear them at marketplace.org. Fishermen and women along the Gulf Coast now find themselves in a situation familiar to so many other industries. The auto industry, even shuttle astronauts. What happens when your chosen livelihood is upended by technology or globalization, or in this case, ecological catastrophe? How do you plan? How do you recover? How do you know when it's really time to start thinking about a different line of work? We're going to put those questions to Gary Chasen. He's a professor of industrial relations at Clark University's Graduate School of Management. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Is it too early to be talking about the end, or at least potentially years-long break, for the fishing industry in the Gulf of Mexico?
I don't think it's too early to talk about that. I think the fishing industry in the Gulf of Mexico is pretty much gone. We just don't know if it's going to be gone in Louisiana or Alabama or Mississippi, or if it's going to affect a large part of Florida or even the Atlantic coast. But we know that there's going to be bad news coming out of this.
Well, so I know that you've spent a lot of time studying what happens when industries find themselves in this position, whether it's the auto industry or the finance industry recently, even journalism right now, newspapers. What does history tell you about what's going to happen here for these workers?
We're going to have two waves of bad effects. The first will be the workers who actually lose their jobs. And in the case of the fishermen in the Gulf, it's not only losing their jobs, but losing their boats and probably losing their homes as well. And the second effect will be the effect on the communities that they live in. The tax base will decrease. The families will be moving out of those towns. Teachers will lose their jobs, and police and firefighters will lose their jobs as well. And even then, more people will leave those towns. So essentially, we're not only seeing an ecological disaster in the Gulf, we're seeing an employment disaster and a social disaster as well.
What are some of the options, aside from having, you know, a sizable savings account, when you start to see that your entire livelihood could be threatened? You know, how do you prepare for that particularly when it happens so suddenly, like it's happening in the Gulf?
Well, if you're fortunate to be living in an area where there is also growing sectors of the economy, for instance, in education or teaching, then you might be able to establish a foundation of skills, which then could be further developed with training. But fishermen live in towns which are dependent on the fishing industry. It's one thing to say we're going to develop new skills and establish a foundation of skills that will help us find jobs. But job retraining programs will help workers if there are jobs available. But if there aren't jobs available, then it can just be frustrating.
And, you know, when a job isn't just a job, you know, it's your identity, it must be hard to admit that anything could happen to it and hard to think of yourself doing anything else.
Well, probably the saddest part about what's happening in the Gulf Coast is that this is the identity of the workers who are fishing there and shrimping there. This is what they've been doing for generations. And the assumption was that the jobs would always be there and that they would have these jobs, which not everyone could do. And this is going to disappear.
And I wonder if there are also extra hurdles when you've trained for something either highly skilled, you know, the Orion space program is phasing out. You've literally got rocket scientists who are out of work, or highly specialized, like the oystermen and the shrimpers. You don't really have any sort of generalized skill to fall back on.
Exactly. The problem is that these people have become so specialized that they specialize themselves out of the market if emergency situations do occur. So, for instance, people who work in defense industries or in the space program, when their jobs go, they have to make a major readjustment. And what they thought of as a prestige position that they earned no longer is there. It just seems tremendously unfair.
So is there a lesson here for all of us to take home?
I think the lesson here for all of us is to try to find positions in industries where we have a broad foundation of skills, and to be expect that the job we have now will not last forever, and that we can maintain some flexibility and move on to other jobs if we have the basic foundation which enables us to do that.
Gary Chason teaches labor relations at Clark University. Thanks so much for chatting with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Walking away is something of a trend these days. Homeowners and their mortgages, Al and Tipper, us and our banks.
I think they lent money they shouldn't have lent. I think they're still giving out giant bonuses, and I don't think I should spend money with somebody who behaves that way.
We'll hear what it's like to divorce Chase, J.P. Morgan, and B of A. That's later on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And it's time once again for your questions. And helping us out with that this week is our own economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
So I have to ask you, you know, we've been talking already in this show about what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico. And of course, apart from the environmental devastation, the story now is really turning to jobs and, you know, what a lot of these folks in the Gulf Coast are going to do now, potentially for years. And I guess I want to ask you what your advice is for someone whose industry is in serious jeopardy.
I would spend a lot of time up front, moving quickly, to find out every local, state, and government program that you can tap into to get money at a community college to pick up some skills that you're going to need. So right now, it's the trauma. It's the shock. But there is going to be money available. There is money already available. And I would be moving really quickly to tap into that because, you know, as you say, Tess, this is going to go on for years.
And, you know, you and I have talked about this before in the context of, for example, Detroit or even the newspaper business, where you've spent your whole life doing something that you think is going to go on forever. And kind of how do you prepare for the eventuality that it might not?
It's a harsh country. Because the way that we deal with that is you move. You know, the fact of the matter is, there's always some part of this country that's doing really well. I mean, right now, for example, North Dakota. It's really a dramatic difference from what you're seeing in Detroit is a good example. So in our society, it's very harsh, but people pick up and they move to where the jobs are.
All right. Well, let's go to the phones where we've got Sadie from Minneapolis. And Sadie, I'm assuming that you're listening to us on KNOW in St. Paul?
Yes, that's right.
And I know that you would have been listening last week, but you were in Puerto Rico. How was it?
Yes, that was great.
And I know that you love to cook. Any ideas for some new dishes while you were there?
The mofongo is a dish that's traditional. It's like smashed up plantains or breadfruit. We had it with like a Creole shrimp and lobster.
Ooh, that sounds delicious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this summer we're going to try to recreate the perfect mojito in a mofongo.
Ah, that sounds delightful. I hear the tropical breeze in the background already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you've got cooking cornered, but an accident a few years ago is still affecting your credit several years later. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what happened?
Yeah, I was 19, and I was just, you know, goofing around, and I rode my bike off a ramp and landed on my face.
Now, is this something where you were trying to do a trick off a ramp?
Yeah, I was trying to clear a garbage can, yeah.
Oh, I hope you were at least wearing a helmet.
No.
Oh, Sadie.
I think my friends thought for a moment I was dead. I broke my back, and I didn't have any insurance. And so the bills kept coming in, and they mounted up to somewhere around $25,000,
oh boy.
I think. So that, I mean, I tried to pay some of them, but it just was too much. So I thought that the smartest thing to do would be to declare bankruptcy. So I did that. And just recently I decided, well, maybe I should start working on my credit. And I went to a bank to apply for a secured credit card. And it turned out that I wasn't even available for that because I had a credit score of 0.
That's pretty unusual, isn't it, Chris?
Yes, it is very unusual. And I guess you just aren't using credit at all. The one nice thing is that credit scores aren't forever. Mm-hmm. And bankruptcy stays on your credit report for 10 years and then it disappears.
I'm luckily so close to being eligible for a secured credit card. They said September will be my 5-year mark. So at that point, I can actually start applying for stuff.
Tess, I should probably just give a quick definition of what is a secured credit card.
Sure.
Most people have what we call an unsecured credit card. So it's basically your word that you're going to pay off the balance. With a secured credit card, you go to the bank and you put down $100 to $500. So it's called a secured credit card because it's secured by this special savings account. You know, the goal is you want to get rid of it. But again, it is the way that you build that credit history.
Is there any way to do that without going the credit card route? I mean, if you've been in financial straits and you don't want to use credit cards, is there any other way to get a score?
Well, there are. Now, one of the ironies of life is that if you've declared bankruptcy, it's really easy to get an auto loan.
How is that possible?
Tess, this is America. How is it possible? Now, to give you a serious answer, the serious answer is you can't declare bankruptcy for another 8 years. So in one sense, you're considered a reasonable risk. Hmm. Plus, they charge you a really high interest rate.
Yeah.
And then there are the other classic little techniques that you can pursue. Many times people will turn to their parents and say, or grandparents and say, will you co-sign? That's another way that you can oftentimes build up a credit history. Or, you know, try and get a gasoline credit card. That used to be a classic way. But in today's world, the secured credit card is probably the main vehicle for rebuilding that credit history.
So if she does that, given that she is now at 0 on her credit score, how long is it going to take to build that up?
It'll build up pretty quickly.
Really?
It'll build up very quickly. And remember that you're used a credit card not as a credit card, but as a way to build your credit score. You use it, but only a little bit of money that you pay off at the end of the month. So there's really no issue about carrying debt.
So, Sadie, it sounds like you've already got a good step underway, at least, with this secured credit card. Are we still doing tricks off of bike ramps?
No, just riding on level ground with a helmet.
Now, if you are brave enough to get back on a bike after what happened to you, I don't think you're going to have any trouble getting your credit back on track.
Not at all.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And if you're trying to get back on track, but you need just a little help, do give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can always write us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. So let's go over to Omaha, Nebraska, and Ron is on the phone with us. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Tess.
What's your local station where you are?
KIOS 91.5 FM.
All right. And so you're there in Omaha. You had any run-ins with the Oracle, Mr. Warren Buffett?
No, in fact, I live about four blocks away from him. He lives on top of the hill, and I live on the bottom. And I keep waiting for some good advice to come down the street. It hasn't happened yet.
Come rolling down from above?
Yes.
Wow, you really live four blocks from him, huh?
One of the things that I like about him is that this is just a very ordinary middle-class neighborhood. And in the league that he's in, people usually think in terms of compounds with
right.
huge stone walls around
yeah.
them. And Mr. Buffett lives in a very middle-class home. Another couple blocks north of where he lives is the grocery store that his dad or his grandpa used to run.
Now, I know you're retired, but you used to work for the Federal Reserve there, right?
I did. Most people think about the Federal Reserve, they think about the Federal Open Market Committee and economists and interest rates.
Right.
And I didn't have anything to do with that, fortunately for the country.
Now, as I said, you're retired, and I understand that you're spending a lot of your time taking care of some family. Tell us
yeah.
about that.
I'm partially responsible for being a caregiver for my mom, for her 94-year-old sister, and for a cousin that she has out in Mount Shasta, California.
Wow.
So just making sure that all of the different documents that have to be in effect and that everything is titled the
sure.
correct way has turned out to be almost a full-time job.
What had they done prior to you starting to look into their finances?
Believe it or not, two of them had handwritten wills.
Wow.
Yeah, I believe it. I do believe that.
Yeah, their grandfather was a fairly astute businessman
mm.
and left an estate that it's not a huge amount of money, and when you live in the same town as Warren Buffett, but it's enough money that it needs to be handled correctly, and my goal was to make sure that the money flows from their estate down to the next generation very smoothly and mm-hmm. without any legal hitches.
Yeah. I always find it fascinating how money made so many years ago can, you know, live and grow and survive and support people, you know, from your great-grandfather.
You may have heard this. There's an old saying that the first generation makes it and the next three spend it. Well, part of my question is that I'm trying to get to where the first generation makes it and the fifth generation has something to show for it. The common statistic is these days is that only about one in four companies has a defined benefit retirement plan.
Right.
And so I'm kind of banking on the fact that my kids may not have a pension plan.
Oh, I think that's a safe bet.
That's a safe bet, particularly if it's private sector.
Yeah.
Yes.
If they don't have a pension plan, then I want to make sure that the money that my mother has flows down to all my kids. If my mother should survive me, then I want to make sure that I have a trust or whatever I need so that that money gets into my three children. Then to complicate it a little bit more, I'd like to set it up so that they can't draw on it until they're age 60.
So, Chris, there's a little bit of estate planning going on here, I think. But there are two questions. One is, how can he make it so that this all happens if something terrible happens and he does not outlive his mother? And then conversely, how does he plan it, assuming that everything goes in order?
Well, you can absolutely do what you want to do. And it'll be through using trusts.
Okay.
And I mean, my main piece of advice here is to spend the time in Omaha finding a really good estate planning attorney.
Okay.
And the trusts are remarkably flexible instruments.
Okay.
Then there's all kinds of details. Do you want to make this something that you can change your mind? Or is it something that you want to make irrevocable, where changes can't be made? I mean, there's all these kind of layers of complexity, but the basic idea is this is what trusts are designed to do.
Great.
Now, to raise a difficult issue, but to be moving fairly quickly is, you know, you also want this all sort of wrapped up in case your mother starts not being able to deal with finances.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, Chris, we're in good shape as far as the legal documents that are required on mom's side.
Ron, what was that like to have that conversation with your mom?
It's no problem because she's more worried about the grandkids than she is about my brother and I.
Yeah.
which is a little alarming, but it's like, geez, Mom, what about us? No, it's no problem. I think Mom understands that the generation that my children are in is in a much different financial situation than my brother and I are in.
One thing just to, just really applaud is that you've had these conversations with your kids.
Yeah.
And with your mom, and there seems like there's a lot of really open communication going on. And
yeah.
I think Tess and I have run into this again and again. That's actually the real stumbling block. It's not finding a lawyer or getting things set up. It's actually communicating and everybody understanding what is going on.
Yeah, yeah, nobody wants to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, and
you know?
we're very fortunate that my mom and my brother and I all see things very much the same way. So.
Well, good. You can serve as an example for our listeners.
Well, I hope I can keep that up. Thank you both very much for your help, and I enjoy your show very much.
Great. Thanks so much, Ron. Great call.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot.
Bye. All right, back to the phone lines, and we have Bill in Buffalo. Hi, Bill.
Hey, how you doing today?
So I'm sure you've never heard this before, but that would make you Buffalo Bill.
No, I have gotten it. Sometimes it helps because, when I deal with that generation, they feel a little bit more comfortable with me, you know?
All right. Now, before we get to your question, I understand that you take a month off every 5 years or so to go RVing with your family. Is that right?
Yeah, it's our third time doing it, and we committed to doing it every 5 years because you just got to connect. I mean, it's crazy if you don't, you know?
And what's that like living in an RV with your family?
It's more comfortable than camping. But by no means is it staying at the Ritz, you know?
Right, right. Do you tend to stay in upstate New York?
No, we go all over the country, all over North America. Actually, went to Louisiana pre-Katrina. And it was interesting because as Katrina hit, we were back in Buffalo, and my kids really felt empathetic and connected to that area, even though they're only five and change. So,
wow.
No, you just go everywhere. We were in Texas and got invited to someone's farm and saw some newborn pigs. I mean, just really cool stuff that you don't do unless you have time to.
All right. Well, let's get to your question. And I understand that you have a headhunting business?
Yeah, I have a recruiting business. I had it for about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've kind of ebbed and flowed through all the good markets. But when unemployment's high and demand is low, it's really hard to make not even a decent living, but a survival in this market unless you're really dialed in. For most of last year, I had to, manage through and still I'm trying to figure out how to manage through it a lot of the debt that I've accumulated.
So what are you doing right now? What's the situation?
The problem is I'm getting a lot of pressure from people I know to say that, hey, if one thing happens out of my control, I'm done and I got to file for some form of bankruptcy.
Ooh.
But the reality is I'm having a great year. I'm probably going to have my best year ever. But to knock down the debt that I have, people are saying just, scrap it all, start with this best year ever, and then, kind of just look back as a learning lesson. And, yeah, you got a bankruptcy in your background, but, who doesn't? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't feel comfortable with that.
Chris, we are now in a time and age where bankruptcy no longer has the stigma that it had, I think. It's kind of like walking away from your mortgage. It's like you got to do what's best for you. So how does Bill know if that's what he should be doing right now?
Yeah, there's a couple things, Bill. I mean, Tess is absolutely right. It can be much more of a strategic decision, especially when it comes to a business. One rule of thumb that I like on the personal side is if you can come up with a plan that you are out of debt in 5 years, it probably doesn't pay to declare bankruptcy. But if there's a lot of wings and a prayer over that 5 years and it could very easily not happen, then you have to take bankruptcy really seriously.
Bill, have you crunched any of those numbers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know for a fact that I can get out of this in 2 years if the market stays consistent where it is today.
Yeah.
I guess that's a juggle. So here's the my big question. Someday I aspire to hold some flavor of political office.
Ah.
And to me, I think bankruptcy is two big strikes against you. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'd roll the dice and try to keep myself clean just to have that option down the road.
Yeah. Interesting question. That's a political question, Chris. Bankruptcy rule you out with the voters?
No, it does not rule you out. If it's because of your business, actually a lot of people understand the risks of small business and they understand that businesses fail. So, for example, in Silicon Valley, there's that expression that in Silicon Valley, no one succeeds until they've gone under three times.
Huh.
Right.
Where people become vulnerable is on their personal side. They are buying three homes. It shows that they are not fiscally responsible. No, you could be telling a story. I'm a business person. I understand the risks that are going on here. And in fact, I built a business up and it ended up going down. And that's why I want to run for office. And that's why I want to do X, Y, or Z. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Here's my main thought, and you probably, maybe you've already done this, but is to work with an attorney and have, in a sense, an off-the-shelf bankruptcy for yourself while you're still struggling to stay alive, while business is doing good, while you're having a good year, and it's in your back pocket. So if the double dip does happen, you can sort of say, okay, it's time to go to this option. You'll be making a decision that you're in control as opposed to feeling events are pushing you a certain direction.
Yeah, no, a solid plan B.
All right, so when does the campaign start?
2024, 2028, I'm not sure. It depends
okay.
on what President Obama does.
Okay.
So you've got a while to figure this out.
So, all right.
All right, well, Buffalo Bill, great question. Thanks for the call.
Great, thanks a lot. You have a great day now.
Bye-bye. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or you can email your question with the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Chris, thanks so much for helping us out. When are you running for office?
Oh, Tess, I like journalism. I'm never running for office.
All right.
Thank you.
And remember to check with a financial expert before making any big money decisions. Credit card debt, overspent accounts, living paycheck to paycheck, that's not so uncommon these days. But for someone doling out money management advice?
I looked at him and I said, you must be kidding. I'm a personal finance disaster. I mean, how could I possibly take this job?
Coming up, a money writer in deep money trouble. We talked in the last segment about how bankruptcy doesn't carry the social stigma it once did. So many people are having to do it. And just last month, more than 130,000 Americans filed for protection from their lenders, according to the American Bankruptcy Institute. Almost 1.5 million Americans filed last year. Dan Bobkoff of WCPN in Cleveland has the story of what it's like to declare that you've reached the bottom of your financial safety net.
If you find yourself in Blake Brewer's office in Independence, Ohio, you've probably hit the end of the road. Brewer is a bankruptcy attorney, and that means he's also part therapist.
Yeah, we keep a box of tissues handy on the desk because there are a lot of tears shed.
Bankruptcy is embarrassing. It feels like failure, but it can also be liberating.
I guess between switching credit cards, sorry, I get emotional because this is just like, between taking the gamble with different credit cards, 0% interest rates, borrowing money from family and friends, I've done everything that I possibly could.
This single mom didn't want her real name used, so we agreed to call her Serena. She's 36, lives in Cleveland with her 3-year-old daughter, and tried everything to avoid ending up talking to a bankruptcy attorney. She used to work 3 jobs, but when her daughter came along, she cut back to 1 so she'd have more time with her. But her $48,000 a year salary wasn't enough to pay the mortgage and support her child. So she racked up a lot of credit card debt.
It adds up really quick. You don't realize in a month how much money you can spend, even not even doing fun stuff, just putting food on the table or buying things for school and paying for daycare.
Attorney Blake Brewer says more and more of his clients are people like Serena, people who, because of changing circumstances, have had to take drastic steps.
I don't see too much of people who have lived an extravagant lifestyle. Most of the people who come to see me have been living in reduced circumstances for some time, trying to pay the credit card bills.
But there are also those who fell into the credit card trap. Genia was 18 when she got her first credit card.
Yeah, I would say 2006 was when I really got most of my credit thrown at me. I actually had a credit card that had like a $6,000 limit.
Genia, who asked us not to give her last name, spent the next 4 years using as many as 8 credit cards to power her through college. She charged school books and some of her tuition. And she bought some stuff she probably didn't need, like new clothes. She graduated with $30,000 in credit card debt.
Eventually you get to a point where the interest rates are so high and the monthly payments are so high that I couldn't physically make payments anymore.
Add to that one of the worst job markets in years, and you have a recipe for financial meltdown. collections agencies started calling her parents and grandparents, who were
shocked. Shocked. And I was always the good kid growing up, so nobody expected I would get into that kind of trouble. But they knew that I was willing to do whatever it took to fix the problem, and therefore they were willing to help me.
Filing for bankruptcy became a relief, but still felt a bit like a failure.
I was extremely independent, you know. I mean, I had a car in my name, I had all these things, but I had fallen, and it was really hard, especially to be dependent on other people, which I never have been.
No one will tell you going through bankruptcy is fun, but it's so common now, attitudes are changing. Sam Giordano heads the American Bankruptcy Institute. He says that with so many big corporations defaulting, there's less of a stigma now.
The idea that individuals have a higher moral obligation than these other entities that have sought protection under the bankruptcy laws, I think, is a bit dated.
And as Serena, the single mom, starts the bankruptcy process, she can take it from Genia that leaving bankruptcy court can feel great.
You walk out of there feeling like you've got a set of wings and you want to fly. It's a pretty relieving feeling.
Genia says she's better now about budgeting and buying generics at the supermarket, but she is leasing a new car that's $330 a month. It's in her roommate's name. He's got good credit. In Cleveland, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace Money.
Bankruptcy is usually the last resort when you're in money trouble. Hopefully you can get your life under control before taking that drastic step, but that is rarely easy to do. And you might be surprised how universal money troubles can be. Turn the page of any newspaper and you'll find all manner of tales from the financial crypt. Nancy Trejos' story made the papers for reasons you'd never imagine. And she's written a book about it called Hot Broke Messes.
I was in denial for many years about my problems. I made pretty much every financial mistake you can possibly make. I had credit card debt. I bought a car that I could not afford because I thought it was cute. I bought a condo that I really couldn't afford either with someone I was not married to. And then we had to sell it years later at a loss because we broke up. And then I became a personal finance writer for the Washington Post. And it became really impossible for me to deny that I had my own financial problems. I overspent my account 1 month and I didn't have enough money for rent. Here I was, 31 years old and reporter for a major newspaper, and I couldn't pay my rent. And I had to call my parents for help. And that was just a wake-up moment for me. I just decided I need to fix this.
How did you become a personal finance writer?
Well, I had been at the Post for at least 10 years. And one day an editor came to me and said, "Hey, would you consider being the personal finance writer?"
And you said, "Yeah, I'd be perfect at that."
I looked at him and I said, "You must be kidding. I'm a personal finance disaster. I mean, how could I possibly take this job?" We kind of figured that I would actually come up with some good story ideas because I was living this.
Well, and I will certainly admit, as the host of a personal finance show, my finances are far from perfect. So, but, you know, tell us a little bit about what that realization was like for you, that here you are, you know, doling out advice and yet looking at your own finances and going, uh-oh, there's a problem here.
Well, I really started to feel like a phony at some point. Mm. Like I said, I would spend every single day talking to people on the phone who were in so much debt. I mean, they were on the brink of bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. And they would sound really embarrassed. And they would say, "I'm so sorry I'm telling you this. You must think I'm awful." And, you know, I'm supposed to be objective. But I would say to them, "No, I don't. I know exactly what you're talking about."
Well, in fact, you have a chapter in the book where you describe one of your most embarrassing moments as a personal finance writer. You were in a mall looking to interview compulsive shoppers.
Yes, I was actually dreading going there because I was afraid of what I would do. So I told myself, I said, "You are not going to buy anything." But it got to the point where, you know, I said, well, let me just go into the store. I don't like the store anyway, so it'll be fine. I'll be okay in there. But then I saw one store that I do like, and I saw a dress that was really adorable. And
this is while you're out working, looking for people to interview.
Yes, looking for compulsive shoppers. It was terrible. And, well, I ended up buying the dress. And then I went back to the office, and I had this shopping bag. And I went to my desk, and I hid it because I didn't want my editor to see it. And I went up to him just to tell him how the day went. And he said, "Did you buy anything?" And I just turned completely red.
Give away.
And I said, I have to go now.
I'd like to hear a little bit about how you think you got yourself into this mess and ask you a little bit about what your money situation was as a kid. Because I think we find a lot that so many of our money habits are shaped by what we saw our parents doing, what they taught us or didn't teach us. What was your household like?
My parents were immigrants. My dad's from Colombia. My mom's from Ecuador. They didn't make a lot of money. They were just really frugal. They didn't buy anything that they didn't need. I guess I kind of rebelled from that frugal lifestyle for some reason. So when I graduated from high school, I ended up deciding to go to Georgetown. A lot of students there come from affluent families, and I was hanging out with a lot of them. I wanted to do the things they were doing, dress like they were dressing. And at the time, it was very easy to get a credit card, and I did. And I used it. I used it for all these silly things, for outfits and vacations, because I thought, well, you know, I'll get a job later and I'll pay it off. Well, that was obviously the wrong thing to do.
So where are you now with your finances? This was a long process for you.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm still a work in progress. You know, I'm on a budget. I've paid off most of my debt. But like I said, you know, it's still work. I still have to remind myself sometimes, no, don't get that outfit. You don't need it. There are so many people out there in the same situation that I was in. And I think a lot of people are afraid to talk about it. And when you don't talk about your problems, then you don't deal with them. So with this book, I just really wanted to show that, hey, it's okay to admit that you've made financial mistakes, and it's okay to talk about them.
Nancy Trejos is a personal finance columnist for The Washington Post and the author of Hot Broke Messes, How to Have Your Latte and Drink It Too. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Several months ago, we profiled an effort to get Americans to switch their accounts away from the big banks that got bailout money. The Move Your Money campaign started on the Huffington Post. The idea was to punish the scoundrels of the financial crisis and reward well-behaved and more consumer-friendly local banks with your business. Ashley Milne-Tite reports some bank customers have made the move, but others aren't so sure.
Hi.
Good
Hi, buddy.
How are you?
How are you?
With a reception like that, it's no wonder Paul Whitman loves going to the bank.
So, I've got some money to deposit here.
Banking wasn't always so much fun for Whitman. He used to have an account with Bank of America, and he did most of his personal banking online. That was fine. Then last year, he moved from New York back home to the Bay Area to start his own company. He opened up some business accounts with B of A, but things didn't go smoothly.
We ran into a lot of glitches that I didn't feel like we really should have. There wasn't a lot of proactive work on the part of the representatives there to help me get important transactions done in a timely way.
He had a lot of questions, and it was tough to get anyone on the phone or in the branch who could answer them. He'd heard local banks pay a lot of attention to customer service, so he began shopping around and found the Bank of Marin.
The phone was picked up usually on the first ring, and the person that picked up the phone had most of the answers. If they didn't have the answers, they committed to getting back to me, and they did call me back with the answers.
Whitman was so thrilled, he decided to dump B of A and go with Bank of Marin. But he did some homework first to be sure the new bank was sound. He checked its balance sheet. Then he moved his money over in stages. Whitman and his new bank are very happy together.
Your online payment is going well?
It is going very well, yeah.
Thousands of account holders may be experiencing similar feelings of satisfaction. A Zogby Interactive poll found 14% of Americans have moved some of their money from a mega bank to a smaller one during the last year. So how do the big banks feel about this desertion? A spokesperson for Bank of America said she couldn't speak to Paul Whitman's specific case, but she says the bank is making changes in response to customer feedback. In New York, Citibank has been cozying up to customers. Manhattan division manager Bill Brown says the campaign is called Our Promise.
We recognize that there's much for us to do to continue to earn or to win back the business and trust of our customers.
Our promise kicked off last fall when the bank announced branches would stay open till 6 instead of 4. More branches are now open on Saturdays and some on Sundays. Bill Brown says staff hit the sidewalks to promote the campaign.
And it was not without some fear that what would the response of the average person be on the street to meeting a city employee or meeting someone who is handing out city literature.
But no one was chased down the block. He says customers appreciate the fact that they now have their branch manager's personal email address and direct line. He says his bank can deliver the same kind of service community banks offer and a lot more besides. But some people still don't buy the idea that the big banks really care about anyone but themselves.
I think they lent money they shouldn't have lent. I think they're still giving out giant bonuses. And I don't think I should spend money with somebody who behaves that way.
Glenn Goldstein banks with Chase. He's not very happy with them, but he can't quite bring himself to walk away. Goldstein runs a bike tour business in Narrowsburg, New York. He has flirted with his local bank, but all his vendor accounts are with Chase, and he says transferring them would be a huge hassle. And there's another reason to stay put.
Chase gives me frequent flyer miles every time I spend with my debit card, and that influences me. I'm not a big business, but I probably spend enough that I don't need to spend for airline tickets for the entire year. And my new small bank would not offer that service. They don't offer that perk.
They don't have a 24-hour service line either. Goldstein says sure, his relationship with Chase may be dysfunctional at times, but at least he can call them at 2 a.m. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Time for your thoughts and comments about the stories you've heard on our show. Recently, we covered a proposal in the New Jersey legislature to make retailers process rebates on behalf of their customers. Ron Kraft of San Francisco wrote to tell us that he's gotten rebates for everything from toilets to dishwashers, and that claiming a rebate really isn't that hard. Consumers who are too lazy or busy, he puts that in quotation marks, to claim them, don't deserve them. A couple of weeks ago, we aired a dueling commentary between a mom and daughter on the sticky subject of allowance. Beth Koblenner and her daughter Becca don't exactly agree on what's fair. Becca gets $14 a week, which did not cover a recent $60 makeup purchase. Cindy Chudikoff hears us in Deerfield, Illinois, and had a suggestion.
Get a job, babysit, walk the neighbor's dogs, help a younger student with his math homework. I'm pretty certain the $60 makeup needs she had would not have been so necessary if it had taken her 2 weeks of working to earn that money.
Robert Slate of San Rafael, California said he'd take Becca's old allowance of $1 a week without complaint. And he signed his email, sincerely, 86-year-old. People used to spend lots of money on music. These days, not so much. We recently explored how and why people decide to illegally download music. A source in our story, who went by the name of Al, said information should be free because it wants to be free. Christine Trowbridge of Alamogordo, New Mexico, is not buying that argument.
Information does not want to be free. You want information, in the forms of music, films, or the like, to be free so that you can avoid paying for it. What would happen if you filled your cart at the grocery store and, on reaching the cashier, announced that you weren't going to pay because calories want to be free?
Meanwhile, Laurel Hechinova called in from Chicago, concerned for the home front of Yours Truly.
I felt a twinge of panic in my gut when I heard Tess announce that a certain member of her household downloaded Friday Night Lights before it was publicly available. Maybe I'm being overly cautious, but it seems as though she may have just given up said family member on air.
No worries. Said family member does not share my last name. Besides which, he'd already been caught and sent a cease and desist letter. And finally, for all the darts that have been hurled at the airline industry, including our interview last month with a Dartmouth professor who is suing over lost luggage, Ralph Snow of Woolwich, Maine, wanted to share a laurel.
It was 2 days before Christmas, and I had just returned from a long deployment in the Far East. And my flight bag containing presents for my mother, my fiancé, and her parents was lost. But by Christmas morning, the airline called to get directions for a staff person from the airport to deliver my flight bag. It arrived, no charge, before we opened our presents.
We'll take your darts and laurels right to us at marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time in fundraising, as in life, it's the little things that matter.
$10, you know, anything, you know. A couple of Starbucks is all we're asking for.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Jolie Myers. Special thanks this week to senior editor Patty Hirsch. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yorb. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, working to solve America's retirement savings challenge through innovation, service, and performance. Putnam, a world of investing.
American Public Media.